expedites heard that the repairing of the walls of Jerusalem was going forward and that the breaches were beginning to be closed, they were very angry. And they all plotted together to come and fight against Jerusalem and to cause confusion in it. And we prayed to our God and set a guard as a protection against them day and night. In Judah it was said, the strength of those who bear the burdens is failing. There is too much rubble. By ourselves we will not be able to rebuild the wall. And our enemies said, they will not know or see till we come among them and kill them and stop the work. At that time the Jews who lived near them came from all directions and said to us 10 times, you must return to us. So in the lowest parts of the space behind the wall, in open places, I stationed the people by their clans, with their swords, their spears, and their bows. And I looked and arose and said to the nobles and to the officials and to the rest of the people, do not be afraid of them. Remember the Lord who is great and awesome, and fight for your brothers, your sons, your daughters, your wives, and your homes.
So, Sanballat, Tobiah, and the enemies pretty much on every side. Sanballat and Tobiah were Samaritans on the north. The Ammonites were on the east. The Arabs would have been in the south. The Ashdodites on the west. And they know that they are continuing to rebuild the walls, and they're upset. And they decide to get a little tougher. They conspire to come and fight. It apparently is going to take more than ridicule and foxes to stop this work. And they're ready to put some teeth into their opposition. They're pretty desperate. And really, you think about it, what might have happened had they chosen to, try to attack these Jews rebuilding the wall? Who had authorized the wall to be rebuilt? The king. I mean, I think they're taking some risk by thinking about doing this. But still, they're desperate, who knows, and this is pretty, disturbing to the Jews. What did they do? How did they respond in verse 9? They prayed and set up a guard. So you first pray, and then you do what you can do. We've talked about that several times. You've got that same pattern. Trust in God is not incompatible with sensible precautions. And so they do that. But there's a lot of factors that are discouraging the work. Look at verse 10. In Judah it was said, the strength of the burden bearers is failing. There's much rubbish. We can't rebuild the wall. What do you see starting to happen?
Discouragement.
What causes the discouragement? Besides the opposition, what else do you see? You know, initially you're excited, you're fired up, you want to get this job done, but then as you start working on it, you're barely making a dent. You know, there's all kinds of debris, there's a lot of work to do, they get tired of carrying rocks and timber and all that. It just seems like, man, it was a lot easier to start this thing than to keep going. Don't you find that true? How many times have you started a really important project and you didn't finish it for the Lord? A bunch of times, right? You know, and that's where they're at. This is, they've got the external opposition, they've got their just own, feeling tired and kind of overwhelmed and like this will never end. And the enemies kept saying, we're gonna fight. And so the Jews who live near them, look at verse 12. What do the Jews who live near the enemies do? They warn the people of Jerusalem how often? So they keep hearing these rumors from the enemies. They keep coming to Jerusalem 10 times. That may be a figurative amount, but the point is they just kept over and over saying, the enemy's coming, the enemy's coming, they're armed, they're gonna do something. So that's just kind of further demoralizing, kind of adding insult to injury, as if that was what the builders needed to hear. And, it's hard enough to remove all the rubble and carry it out of the city, and now they're being told they're gonna be slaughtered while they're doing it. And this is just conspiring to really put some negative, you know, thinking in the Israelites. And so, you know, Nehemiah put some men with their swords, spears, and bows in the exposed place in the wall, and he tells them, trust in the Lord. I appreciate that. In verse 14, do not be afraid of them. Remember the Lord who is great and awesome, and fight for your brothers, your sons, your daughters, your wives, and your houses. We're going to stick together, and we're going to trust in the Lord. He is our strength. But you would assume that this is a challenge for Nehemiah himself. You know, he's the guy who's leading this, he's the guy they turn to, and when they start losing morale and the enemy starts really threatening, you're under a lot of pressure, you feel a lot of responsibility, you feel the discouragement, and so you appreciate Nehemiah just continuing to consistently turn to God and encourage the people and keep dealing with the situation face up and moving forward. There will be opposition, there will be discouragement, it won't be easy. Everything we do in the work of the Lord, Satan's going to try to tear it down. He's going to try to get us to stop. And so don't expect it's going to be easy. It's going to take people who have determination and who are willing to pray about it. Thoughts and comments.
When they were about to stone David, he encouraged himself.
In the Lord, which is exactly what we have to do. Mike.
You see these people, they're trying to rebuild the wall and they're facing the real prospect of possibly being killed.
That's right.
So that's got to weigh on their minds, and yet Nehemiah rallies them and tells them to focus on God. It just reminds me, as Christians today, there may come times that we face persecution. It's hard to imagine at that level, but it could happen. Jesus tells us not to fear those who kill the body, rather fear him who we send them to hell. So our ultimate, we fear God so deeply that we really don't fear what people may do to us or
threaten. Yeah, I mean, clearly in the first century, there were times when people's preaching cost their life. Think about Stephen. You know, I mean, what would you do if it really could come down to that? If you knew some brethren who, because of their preaching and teaching, were stoned to death or executed like James was or whatever. So you knew, really, it's a real possibility. You could be taking your life in your own hands to preach the gospel and to teach people about the Lord. Would you still do it? So why don't we now when we don't have that? You know, I think there's a way in which we might rise up and say, yes, I'd do that. I wouldn't let them stop me, so what are we letting stopping us now? You know, they preached because they were scattered by persecution. We ought to preach even more because we're not. You know, we have every reason to teach the gospel. And if somebody looks at us cross-eyed or slams the door in our face, so be it. And I understand I'm not a great example in that. You know, I pray for boldness a lot. But we need it and we ought to have it. And I appreciate Nehemiah. Man, I mean, he's come a long ways from serving wine to the king. You know, he is really on the front line and he's dealing with their discouragement and he's handling it. Trusting in the Lord. Okay? All right, how about 15 to 23?
It happened when our enemies heard that it was known to us that and that God had brought their counsel to nothing, that all of us returned to the wall, everyone to his work. So it was from that time on that half of my servants worked at construction, while the other half held the spears, the shields, the bows, and wore armor, and the leaders were behind all the house of Judah. Those who built on the wall and those who carried burdens loaded themselves so that with one hand they worked at construction, and with the other held a weapon. Every one of the builders had his sword girded at his side as he built, and the one who sounded the trumpet was beside me. And I said to the nobles, the rulers, the rest of the people, the work is great and extensive, and we are separated far from one another on the wall. Therefore, wherever you hear the sound of the trumpet, rally to us there. Our God will fight for us. So we labored in the work, and half of the men held the spears from daybreak till the stars appeared. At that time I also said to the people, let each man and his servant stay at night in Jerusalem, that they may be our guard by night, and but working party by day. So therefore I and my brethren, my servants, nor the... So neither I, my brethren, my servants, nor the men of the guard who followed me took off our clothes, except that everyone took them off for one.
Do you know there are just interesting features in a text like this? Let me show you one. Look at verse 1 of chapter 4. Now it came about that when Sanballat heard... Look at verse 7. Now when Sanballat and all these other groups heard... And then look at verse 15. When our enemies heard... Those are the divisions of that chapter. It breaks between 1 to 6 and then 7 to 14 and then 15 and following. Based upon when they heard... When they heard, when they heard. See, hear that kind of that structure that is in that. That's just a curiosity. It's not something that's going to be critical to you. But they heard that God had frustrated their plan. Notice who gets the credit for frustrating their plan. God had frustrated it. When they heard that, they returned to the wall. They worked, and some of them were ready for battle, some of them were working, or sometimes they carried the spear in one hand and the, you know, rebuilding tool in the other, but they kept building. We don't stop the work, and we're willing to come to rally to each other's aid when the trumpet's blown, and we trust in God that God will work for us. And we just keep working, and we decided, you know, to just stay on the job, not even to go back home, because that way you get every moment of daylight in that you can, and you avoid leaving the city exposed to attacks at night. But they continue working, they continue working, they continue working. And that's the thing, there's going to be problems, there's going to be opposition. But you know what happens to churches? When churches have problems, they quit working a lot of times. They quit trying. They quit doing much. We just kind of turn in on ourselves. I appreciate the fact here that Nehemiah and these people, they are still building that wall. They may be having to, you know, post part of them as a guard, or they may have to be doing this or that, but they're not stopping that work on that wall. And if we've got that mentality, we're still going to work for the Lord. There may be problems, there may be things we have to work on, but we're still going to work for Him. That's the recipe for success. Thoughts and comments? Yes?
Going with verse 15 that says, God has frustrated their plans. Proverbs 16:9 says, the heart of man plans his way, but the Lord establishes his steps. How many times have we started to make plans and we don't see the future that it might be leading us in a direction that's not according to God's word? And I just think, I pray that God frustrates my plans.
Yeah, good point. Yes, sometimes it's a blessing when He does. I agree. Other thoughts?
Verse 23, you see the dedication of Nehemiah to the work. He was actively involved and engaged in what was going on. He didn't put himself above anybody.
Yes, Nehemiah's right in the middle of it. He is not the guy who's just sitting in some plush office giving orders. He's right in the middle of the fight. He's joining with them every bit of the way. Yeah, great attitude on Nehemiah's part. Great leadership principles from this book. Okay? We got another problem. You know, as if this wasn't enough, there's a whole different type of problem that occurs in chapter 5, and we'll see how they deal with that, verses 1 to 5.
And there was a great outcry of the people and their wives against their Jewish brethren. For there were those who said, we, our sons and our daughters, are many, therefore let us get grain that we may eat and live. There were also some who said, we have mortgaged our lands and vineyards and houses that we might buy grain because of the famine. There were also those who said, we have borrowed money for the king's tax on our lands and vineyards. And now our flesh is the flesh of our brethren, our children as their children. Indeed, we are forcing our sons and our daughters to be slaves, and some of our daughters have been brought into slavery. It is not our power to redeem them, for our other men have our lands and our vineyards.
So, here's a problem. Now, think about what's happened. Everybody stopped and started working on the wall. They're not doing their farm work. They're not doing their day job. We're working on the wall. And that brings an economic crisis to a head. And what's happened is many of these guys have debts and, you know, they don't have a way to pay them. They're not making any money right now. And so, you know, see several problems. You know, some of them didn't have any food. Verse 2. You know, you can't eat walls. You know, in verse 3, some of them were mortgaging their fields and their vineyards and their houses trying to get some grain to eat. In verses 4 and 5, there were some of them who had had to borrow money to pay the property tax, and they're pretty much to the point they're going to have to sell their children into slavery to pay off their debts to their brethren. So this is creating a real problem. You know, I mean, it's fellow Jews that they're owing the money to, and fellow Jews that aren't giving them the food. And so it's creating some tension among them. And you understand this puts a lot of pressure on a guy who's spending full time building a wall while his kids are starving, or while he's had to mortgage everything he owns, or while he's feeling like, you know, the only choice I've got is to sell my kids into slavery to pay off my debts that the moneylenders are breathing down my back to get. You know, it creates tension, it demoralizes. They've already got all these other problems. You know, the external opposition and just the you know, weariness of the task and the burden. So this is just adding insult to injury again. This is more than they needed. And you know, it never fails. The moment that everything is overwhelming and you're dealing with a bunch of crises all at the same time, some other catastrophe drops into your lap. It's like, you know, this is more than I can handle. Well, the truth is, the Lord knows how much we can handle, and sometimes it's more than we think we can. And, you know, I appreciate Nehemiah. He's going to deal with this. He's going to deal with this very directly and very firmly, but he's not going to just say, I give up. He's not going to just say, this is enough on the walls. You know, we've got to keep working, and we've got to deal with the problem. But this is a crisis, and there's a whole different line of crises than what we've been seeing in these earlier chapters. Thoughts and comments. Do you understand the crisis here? Now, let's see how they deal with it. What steps does Nehemiah take? 6 to 13.
I was very angry when I heard the outcry of these words. I consulted with myself and contended with nobles, rulers, and said, you're exacting usury, each from his brother. Therefore, I held a great assembly against them. I said to them, we, according to our ability, have redeemed our Jewish brothers who were sold to the nations. Now, would you even sell your brothers that they may be sold to us? And they were silent, could not find a word to say. Again, I said, the thing which you are doing is not good. Could you not walk in fear of our God because of the reproach of the nations, our enemies? And likewise, I and my brothers and my servants are lending them money and grain. Please let us leave off this usury. Please give back to them this very day their fields, their vineyards, their olive groves, and their houses. Also, the 100th part of the money of the grain, the new wine, and the oil that you are exacting from them. Then they said, we will give it back and will require nothing from them. We will do exactly as you say. So I called the priests and took an oath from them that they would do according to the promise. I also shook off the front of my garment and said, thus may God take out every man from his house and from his possessions who did not fulfill his promise. Even thus may he be shaken out and emptied. And all the assembly said, Amen. And they praised the Lord.
Okay, so first reaction of Nehemiah, he was very angry. Sometimes that's all that happens. We just get angry. But Nehemiah didn't just stay angry. He was very angry. He consulted with himself, meaning he reflected. I had a teacher in school that would always say, and I said to myself, self, and he went on to whatever he said to himself, but he thinks about it, he reflects on it, and he confronts the nobles and the rulers, and he just comes right out and says, you are exacting usury, each from his brother, and he held a great assembly against them and laid it on the line. Now, he needs the support of these leaders, but they were wrong in what they were doing. These are brothers that they are, you know, acting like a bunch of loan sharks and pawnbrokers and demanding payment when these guys are working on the wall. And you know, relationships among brothers should never be treated as mere business transactions. This is in the family of God, and they're working together, and they've got to stop this. And you know, you feel like Nehemiah has just such a passion for what's right that he almost throws caution to the wind. I mean, this is a pretty direct statement. And he says, we, according to our ability, have redeemed our Jewish brothers who were sold to the nations. Now, would you even sell your brothers that they may be sold to us? You know, he's just, wow, I mean, I can't believe you're doing this. And they didn't say anything. He said, the thing which you are doing is not good. You know, you need to fear God. And so again, he is not mincing words. But then look at verse 10. He admits his own involvement. Likewise, I, my brothers, and my servants are lending them money and grain. Please let us leave off this usury. So he's calling for a change in this. And he says, I'm going to be the first to change. I've done this, and I'm not going to do it anymore. And I'm going to leave this off. I mean, you appreciate a leader who's willing to say, all right, it's my fault too. I've done it too, and I will not do it again, and I will take the lead in treating my brothers right. But he's not some arrogant guy who says, well, I have never done anything like that. Yes, he has. And he admits his involvement and his determination to change. And he says, all right, here's what you gotta do. Don't charge interest anymore. That's the end of verse 10. Give the collateral back, their fields, their vineyards, their olive groves, their houses, and all that. Verse 11, and quit charging the 1% a month interest. I think it's monthly, this hundredth part, that'd be 1%. So they've been charging them a percent a month interest, and he said, quit it. So don't charge the interest, give back what you've been charging, return the collateral, and just have a whole change of concept. You know, I mean, they're brethren. Brethren love each other. The well-being of our brethren is more important than our financial situation. You got to be willing to sacrifice. The situation here called for gifts, not for loans. And the people say, we'll give it back. Verse 12, we'll require nothing from them. We'll do exactly what you say. I'm a little surprised at that. But Nehemiah was saying the right thing. This was clearly right. This is clearly what ought to be done. And there are times when, if we will just say, look, here is what must be done. This is what the Lord says. And we do it with love, firmness, but love, with a humbleness to recognize our own involvement. People will follow. Good brethren will say, you're right, I was wrong, and I'll change. Sometimes we don't have enough passion for the will of the Lord to just be willing to confront when it needs to be confronted. And he takes an oath from them that they're going to do it. You know, he's not willing to leave this to chance. And he shakes out his garment and says, may God shake out everybody from everything he owns if he doesn't do this. You know? And so, I mean, he's pretty passionate about this. But you recognize with Nehemiah, this is not some false passion. He's been passionate enough about the walls to cry about it for months and pray about it and get out there and work in it. Now, a man like that deserves to be heard when he confronts us about our selfishness and our stinginess. You know, we've got to listen to him on that too. And there may be times when you get confronted, and it doesn't feel good. I hate being confronted. I hate being reproved. But I need it. And it helps me do better. And praise God for it. And we're just going to have to listen sometimes to some brethren who care about us, who say, look, you're wrong, and you've got to change this. And we need to listen and be humbled. And sometimes we may need to be the brother that goes and frankly and honestly confronts. So I'm really shocked that things had gotten to this point, and I'm really encouraged by Nehemiah's willingness to deal with it, and I'm encouraged by the fact that they immediately submit, and they don't try to defend themselves, and they don't, you know, get upset with Nehemiah. Thoughts and comments?
Kind of alluded to this, but I'm impressed that Nehemiah is very angry, and then still has some serious thought about it in verse 7.
Yeah.
My tendency is to get very angry and go ahead and do something about it while I'm angry about it. But he takes the time to think about it before he does anything.
Yes. The righteous anger may help motivate us, but it's got to be carefully controlled. Mike.
Yeah, anytime God's people are trying to do His will, destroying the building the wall and all that. It's a good thing to do. Temptation comes in there. It, within churches or whatever, that in this situation, we can find its way in there, and then we have to find a way to deal with that. But it's just a reminder, if we move forward, whether from outside or in our own inner thinking, temptation can arise that causes a major setback.
Yes. You're exactly right. Yeah. And Satan works his way in so many different ways. It's amazing. It really, you know, it makes you think, I think, you know, we need to be generous. And I understand that we live in a country with a lot of economic opportunity, and certainly with a lot of laziness. But I think we sometimes get to being awfully capitalistic in our thinking. You know, you get what you deserve and that's that. And if you don't earn it, I'm not going to give it to you. And there are times we need to be generous. And there are people who need help. And we need to be willing to do that. You know, we shouldn't be in this mindset that I'm going to take everything I'm entitled to. You know, I'm going to get everything I can because after all, I deserve it. You know, I mean, what if the Lord treated us that way? The Lord is gracious and merciful to us. Now, He's not gracious to us in ways that hurt us. I understand that sometimes we can be generous in a way that really hurts somebody. And we don't want to do that. We don't want to be an enabler in something that really hurts them. But God is a generous God with us. And He's patient and merciful. And maybe we're going to get took one of these days. So be it. How many people have taken the Lord? So I just really appreciate this attitude. And I feel like, you know, we need a good, you know, just rethinking of, you know, our attitude toward material things. John?
Well, especially when it comes to family relationships, which is what the Church of God is. Capitalism works great. It's wonderfully great system, you know. But I've never raised any kids, never made any mistakes, even raising kids. But I think if I ever do raise children, if I take a capitalistic approach to raising them, you know, everything you do in this family, you got to earn, and you got to do this, I don't think it'll work out too well. You know, families may do some of that to try to teach their kids how the real world is and teach a work ethic. All that's well and good. But to try to run a whole family based on capitalism. Now, if you're 5 years old, but you're not really earning your keep, right? You know, that's not going to work very well. We're in the family of God. We're not, we might do some things capitalistic oriented to try to help each other learn lessons or something. Maybe.
Sure.
Same thing with the physical family. But in general, we're not running this family based on capitalism. We're basing it on family. And family's not something where you have to, you know, well, if I don't act this right, you know, my parents will no longer speak to me and whatever. No, it's family. And God set it up that way on purpose, and we should do it His way.
Amen. Sure. Yeah, that's very helpful. And I think that's exactly the point. And we need to have that brother-to-brother spirit. Other thoughts? Well, the next section, I mean, is from a later period, or at least a longer period than just this building project, but it really shows you Nehemiah as an example in this. So 14 to 19.
Servants domineered the people. But I did not do so because of the fear of God. I also applied myself to the work on this wall. He did not buy any land, and all my servants were gathered there for the work. Moreover, there were at my table 150 Jews and officials, besides those who came to us from the nations that were around us. Now that which was prepared for each day was one ox and six choice sheep. Also birds were prepared for me. In months and 10 days, all sorts of wine were furnished in abundance. Yet for all this, I did not demand the governor's food allowance, because the servitude was heavy on his people. Remember me, O my God, for good, according to all that I have done for this people.
All right, so this deals with a 12-year period here even, where Nehemiah doesn't take what he rightfully deserves as governor. He had the right to demand a food allowance and to be supported, and he didn't ask for that. He didn't demand that. You know, he didn't receive that. You know, he was entitled to a lot of stuff he didn't take, because he was generous. And he recognized the burden on the people and their situation, and he's not trying to get everything he can get. You know, he's generous and is self-denying in that. And, you know, he wants the Lord to remember him for what he's done. So Nehemiah himself is a model of a willingness to make sacrifices and to be generous when he could have asked for the food allowance. He evidently had full right to it, but he chose not to. Great attitude on his part. And, you know, you recognize Nehemiah is practicing what he preaches. Thoughts and comments.
Just wonder what happened to that definite period he's going to go back.
It's really hard to figure all that. I don't know if this is he went back and came back, because he goes back again later and comes back, or exactly how that was. I don't know. Good question.
How did he afford to do all this?
I don't know that either. Can we assume he had a lot of 401ks from his time as a cupbearer? I don't know. Yeah, I don't know. Obviously, he's paying his debts. I don't think he's in a position where he's not affording it, but we don't really understand the full situation with him.
Are you saying, Gary, you can't answer what God didn't tell you?
I can't. Sometimes I can't answer the things he did, so... Other thoughts?
You thank God with God's help, though.
Yes, definitely. And
that's the main one.
Yes, amen. Yeah, this is not Nehemiah on his own. He certainly gives credit to the Lord constantly for everything that he does. We need to, too.
In his last statement, I've heard some suggest, was he being boastful? I certainly don't see that in his character, but asking the Lord to remember the good that he had done to the people.
I think that's what we want the Lord to do. Yeah, absolutely.
The Hebrew writer tells us he's not unfaithful. He doesn't forget the good that we do.
I think we want the Lord to be happy with us. We want the Lord to understand we've tried hard to make sacrifices and be what we ought to be. He's our Father. Other thoughts? Okay. Well, we're still building on this wall. And we really haven't gotten to the end of opposition tactics. So how about chapter 6, verses 1 to 4?
Now it happened when Sambalot, Tobiah, and Geshem there, and the rest of our enemies heard that I had rebuilt the wall, that there were no breaks left in it, though at that time I had not hung the doors and the gates, that Sambalot and Geshem sent to me, saying, "Come, let us meet together among the villages in the plain of Ono." But they thought to do me harm. So I sent messages to them, saying, "I'm doing a great work, so that I cannot come down. Why should the work cease while I leave it and go down to you?" They sent me this message 4 times and answered them in the same manner.
So, things are getting to, you know, a very critical point for these enemies. Because the wall is now pretty much done. There's no holes left in it. It's not put the doors in the gates yet. But we're getting there. And it's not going to be long before Jerusalem's, you know, got a wall around it that's, you know, fully intact and operational. And they're not going to be able to overrun Jerusalem. And they've got to figure out something, and they can't wait long. Maybe they hadn't even expected this work to get along so quickly and so well. And so what are they deciding they've got to do? That's exactly right. And you know, that sometimes is a key strategy. Because if you take the person who's responsible for leading the project out, sometimes that just totally destroys the morale and totally destroys the leadership. And it may very well be, if they could be successful with this, that they'd be able to overcome the wall effort. Now, leaders are strategic, so that's their goal. What can they do to eliminate Nehemiah? And they've got a plan. What's their plan? Yeah, they're asking Nehemiah to come down and meet with them. You know, I'm wondering if this is almost like a concession speech. You know, obviously we've been enemies, but look, you know, we're smart enough to understand that we're going to have to live together. We might as well just be friends, and let's just get together and just, you know, work on this. Let's come up with a pact or a treaty. That's kind of what I'm imagining. I'm not sure that that's the case, but I'm understanding this is not a threatening meeting, but it's more like a collaborative meeting. So come on down, and we just need to meet together, and let's, you know, shake hands and be friends. But what is the truth about their intentions? Yeah, they're going to ambush him or whatever. They're going to get him down there and they're going to jump him or something like that. In fact, I bet you anything, they've already drafted the letter to send back to Jerusalem. You know, we're very sorry to have to tell you there's been an unfortunate accident and unhappily Nehemiah is dead or something like that. They got, you know, their mouth is watering with this. And so they send messengers and invite Nehemiah, and he sends messengers back and says what? I'm too busy. I can't come. You know, I mean, Nehemiah shows a lot of wisdom, I think, in being able to say no to distractions. He's not going to be sidetracked by some summit meeting with his enemies. He's got work to do. You know, and he's not bloated with a sense of his own self-importance, thinking that he's got to take time out to engage in some kind of diplomacy with him. You know, he's not going to go down. He's got something else he's doing. And, well, so how do they respond when Nehemiah refuses? Four times! Actually, they send a fifth time. You know, it's a little different. We'll see it in a minute. But what does that tell you?
Devil's persistent.
That's exactly right. And they have high hopes for this tactic. Or maybe like they're desperate and they don't know anything else they can do. But, you know, they're just determined. He's got to come down. Come on, come on. And you know, sometimes that'll wear you down. Constant temptation. First time, second time, third time, you know, strong resist. But eventually, it just kind of erodes our determination in so many cases. So this is, you know, something to really give thought to. But Nehemiah, I mean, he's not going. And so they might as well forget this one. Four times, he can say no as many times as they want to invite him. Thoughts and comments? 5 to 9.
Exactly.
Well, change tactics just a little bit here. You know, fifth time, what do?
Say they're trying to rebel.
Yeah. Now this is a little complex here. So they send the fifth time, and somebody's got an open letter in his hand, unsealed letter. And in the letter it said, it's reported among the nations, and Gashmu says, that may be the same as Geshem, that you and the Jews are planning to rebel, therefore you're rebuilding the wall, and you're to be their king according to these reports. And you've appointed prophets to say a king's in Judah. And unfortunately, I'm afraid that those reports are going to have to be sent to the king. I believe we probably need to meet and talk about it. Now, they're implying, I think, that they have Nehemiah's welfare at heart. You know, we would hate to have to let the king know about these rumors. You know, and, you know, if you'd come down to Ono, we could talk about it. Maybe there'd be a way of keeping these rumors from reaching the king's ears. So they're kind of trying to force his hand and making him come down there to try to clear himself of suspicion. I mean, you know, Sanballat kind of feels like he's got to inform the king about these rumors, unless maybe if Nehemiah had come down, you know, can confer with him and hear his side of the matter, maybe he wouldn't have to. And so they're really worried about Nehemiah and trying to get him, you know, not to let the rumor get to the king, right? You know, but wait a minute. If that's what they're worried about, what was it that was brought to Nehemiah? What kind of a letter? An open letter that anybody, the messenger, wanted to let stop and read it, they could. You know, it looks to me like this letter is a lot more trying to spread the rumors than to squelch them. You know, why invite Nehemiah to a secret meeting if you're sending an open letter? So I don't think this has anything to do with trying to come up with a deal to avoid the rumors coming to the king. In fact, I have a sneaking suspicion they started those rumors themselves, and they're just trying to come up with some tactic to make Nehemiah feel obligated to go down to this meeting where they'll assassinate him. I think that's what's going on in that. So, but think about poor Nehemiah. Man, what's going to happen if these rumors get back to Artaxerxes? You ever had rumors told on you? You ever had an absolutely, totally, 100% false rumor told about you? That happens. It absolutely happens. This is totally fabricated. Not a grain of truth in this. And, but you know, it can be unsettling. And what am I going to do? You know, the king might believe this. Well, what does Nehemiah do?
Defends himself, first of all.
By saying what?
Now, this was true.
It's not true.
You invented it in your heart.
Yeah. Figment of your own imagination. Not true. You know, we don't need to negotiate. This is false. You know, I mean, listen. If somebody tells lies about you, don't worry about it. They're lies. The thing you worry about is when they tell something true. If it's just a lie, don't forget it. Doesn't matter. You know, we get so disturbed sometimes. Oh, so-and-so said this about me. Is it true? Well, no. Well, okay. Then forget it. I mean, God knows. And probably, if you're a person of consistent character, most other people will figure it out sooner or later. You know, people tend to know your character. And most thinking people will figure it out when it's really not true. But whether they do or not, just do the work of God and don't worry about it. And so I appreciate that. And Nehemiah turns to the Lord again and says, strengthen my hands. You know, they wanted Nehemiah's hands to drop on the work on the wall, but he prays to God that God would strengthen his hands, and he keeps on working. He is not worried about their rumors. He's worried to please the Lord and let the Lord give success to the project. So don't be surprised when there's opposition. Don't be surprised when you hear false rumors. Don't be surprised when things are discouraging. They're going to be discouraging a lot of the time. But you just do the work. Comments and questions.
Jesus and Paul, New Testament examples. Paul took a Gentile to the temple. Jesus said what they say about him. He said, wrong to pay taxes. It was amazing to me after he just told me.
No, I know. Yeah. Yeah, it is. There are times like that that you're thinking, you know, I mean, that was the opposite of what Jesus said. But it's going to happen. People are going to make false accusations. They're going to twist things you said or just invent something that's totally false. Do the right thing. You make sure they're not true. That's all that matters. Well, this, you know, how are you feeling if you're Tobiah and Sanballat and Geshem about now? Kind of got your back to the wall. You know, the window of opportunity is closing fast, and you got to come up with something. You know, because you haven't got much time left. They're going to get those gates hung, and you're going to be sunk. So 10 to 14.
Afterward, I came to the house of Shemaiah, the son of Deliah, the son of Mehetabel, who was a secret informer. He said, "Let us meet together in the house of God, within the temple, and let us close the doors of the temple, for they are coming to kill you. Indeed, at night they will come to kill you." And I said, "Should such a man as I come? Who is there such as I who would go into the temple to save his own life? I will not go in." And I perceived that God had not sent him at all, that he had pronounced this prophecy against me, because Tobiah and Sanballat had hired him. For this reason he was hired, that I should be afraid and act that way in sin, that they might have cause for evil report, that they might reproach me. My God, remember Tobiah and Sanballat according to these their works, the prophets Noadiah and the rest of the prophets who have made me afraid.
Okay, so this is another tactic. Now he goes into Shemaiah's house, and Shemaiah, I assume, is kind of like an old friend, and Shemaiah's got some advice for Nehemiah. What does he tell him to do? You need to get in the temple. You need to protect yourself. I've got good authority. They're coming to kill you tonight. So get in the temple to protect yourself. Now that sounds like he's really looking out for Nehemiah. You know, man, he doesn't want poor Nehemiah to be killed. So you got to get in the temple. They won't find you there. They won't come in there. You know, you'll be safe in there. You know, and so it looks like he's really a man who's concerned about making sure that Nehemiah is safe, and he's really looking out for him. What's Nehemiah's answer? Why not?
Not a priest.
I think that's right. You know, What's going to happen? If Nehemiah went into the temple as a non-priest to save his skin from this rumored assassination attempt, he's going to be totally discredited. You know, here he's urging everybody else to be bold, and he does something sinful, using the temple as a hideout for a non-priest to try to escape from being assassinated. You know, they're going to be able to use this big time to discredit Nehemiah. You know, and Nehemiah's like, no, I will not save my life by going into the temple. You know, his reputation, his honor, and his concern to obey God meant a lot more to him than his life. He won't do this. There are so many times when doing the right thing and being consistent will get you out of a problem. This is just came to my head. But I think it's a worthwhile illustration. It may be a little, off the subject. But I thought about this. I don't know how many of you heard this story. I heard Sewell Hall actually tell it. He has a policy of, like, not being in a single woman's apartment by himself, which I would agree. And I think most of us understand the wisdom of that. Well, he was working with a guy in like a halfway house. And the guy sent him to work with his wife. And she came to church, I think, a little bit. And they tried to study with her some. And that didn't end up working out. She wasn't too interested. But after some weeks, she called Sewell with a really sad story. Things were bad. And she was losing her apartment. She needed money for rent. You know, she was going to be evicted. And she really needed help. And Sewell sympathized with her. And so arranged that he was going to go at noon and he could get some money to her for that. And Kenita wasn't available, so he went with one of the elders. And the two of them went to her apartment and knocked on the door, and nobody was there. Nobody answered the door. So Sewell was kind of worried about that. Later that night, he went back with Kenita. And knocked on the door, nobody. He found the manager of the apartment. He was really concerned about her. The manager's like, she's not behind in her rent. So it's like, you know, kind of dropped it. Like, what's all this about? And Kenita read just a few weeks later in the paper, the most crazy thing, but this scam had been uncovered. They were getting important people, and it was one of these deals. They get them inside the apartment, and there was an unclad woman in the bedroom, and they had a camera filming, and they get some important guy. You know, she'd scream from the bedroom. He'd rush back to see what was going on, and they'd film this guy being with this woman and then blackmail him. Not to publish it or, you know, whatever. And so that's what they were doing with Sewell. But of course, when he comes with another guy as a witness, then it made them not answer the door because they can't do this in that situation. And the fact that he was consistent and he did the right thing and just a matter of principle, he didn't go to a single woman's house by himself. He knew that wasn't the right thing to do, meant that he was in no trouble and nothing could have been done. You know, and it's just one of those things when you always do the right thing, it'll get you out of some problems. He's not going to go into the temple. That's it. That's not the place for him to hide. It's not a place for him to go into. And so they can't do anything. And it causes, he really realizes that God hadn't sent him. He's a tool of Tobiah and Sanballat. They paid him to get him to do that, so that he'd become frightened and act accordingly in sin, so they could say, have an evil report against him. You know, it couldn't have come from God, because God wouldn't encourage him to disobey his laws about the sanctity of the temple. And so Nehemiah was firm even in that crisis. And again, he asked God, remember, O my God, Tobiah and Sanballat according to these works of theirs, and also Noadiah the prophetess and the rest of the prophets who were trying to frighten me. So there's plenty of opposition, but Nehemiah is firm and he asks God to remember him. I mean, Nehemiah's got some encouraging qualities, but it's because he's determined to do the right thing. He is dedicated to really doing what God's word says. And he keeps doing it. And you do that. You trust in the Lord and you turn to the Lord and you pray to the Lord and you don't let anything stop you and you keep doing the work. God will bless it. And he does. Thoughts and comments.
Maybe an example we talked about earlier, he knew that God hadn't sent him. He was asking him to do something simple.
Absolutely, yeah. When that's the case, you know it's not from God. It can't be from God. Other thoughts?
I think there's also a sense that Nehemiah doesn't want to run away. He seems to be a bad look for somebody who's trying to leave the people. He doesn't want to make it look like he's afraid.
Yes, you're right. Yeah. I mean, what a bad example for the others. He's trying to encourage to have courage and toughness. Good point. Other thoughts? All right, so look at what happens. Verse 15. So the wall was completed on the 25th of the month Elul in 52 days. Wow. 52 days! They had been, as we said, broken down in 586, and this is 445. You do the math. They came back originally in about 537, and this is 445. And in 52 days, when Nehemiah got back, they accomplished the project. Wow. Can you imagine that? Less than 2 months. That's all it took. That's amazing. And notice verse 16, when all our enemies heard of it and all the nations surrounding us saw it, they lost their confidence, for they recognized that this work had been accomplished with the help of our God. Also in those days, many letters went from the nobles of Judah to Tobiah, and Tobiah's letters came to them. For many in Judah were bound by oath to him because he was the son-in-law of Shechaniah, the son of Era, and his son Jehonahan had married the daughter of Meshulam, the son of Berechiah. Moreover, they were speaking about his good deeds in my presence and reported my words to him. Then Tobiah sent letters to frighten me. So, he gets the job done. You know, and it's been done with the help of his God. I mean, this is the Lord's work. And just an amazing accomplishment. Who would have ever thought it? And I mean, just again, think about all the obstacles and barriers and difficulties he had to fight through. But you do the right thing and you pray and ask God's help. Here's the result. An amazing result. Spectacular result. And it doesn't stop the opposition. There's letters going back between the nobles of Judah and Tobiah. And it's kind of funny how that works. I mean, he's allied by marriage and by trade and so forth. And what do some of these leaders in Israel say to Nehemiah about Tobiah? Yeah, they put a good word in with Nehemiah. You know, Tobiah's not such a bad person. You ought to have a more positive attitude about him. They kind of do some propaganda in favor of Tobiah, trying to kind of rehabilitate his image for Nehemiah. People do that. Now, you know, I mean, listen, I know this guy, I mean, he's teaching some things that are wrong, and he's, you know, done that, but really, deep down, he's a really good guy. You know, don't be so much against him. Well, then what does Tobiah turn around and do? Sent letters to frighten Nehemiah. So much for the attempt to say he's really a good guy, right? That kind of puts the lie to the attempts of the nobles to make him look better. You know, if he was really that good, what's he doing trying to intimidate Nehemiah again? But, you know, we struggle with this idea, you know, that there's right and wrong, and some people are just trying to destroy the work of God, and we need to understand that and oppose them. Comments and questions? Yes.
Any idea of the dimensions of the city and all that?
You know, I don't really know. But generally speaking, the cities were as small as they could get them. They put the farmland outside the city walls. So, but I don't know. Somebody know the dimensions? I don't. There's probably people who could answer that, but I can't. Caleb?
I think there's any symbolic significance to the 52 days, 7 weeks plus 3 days.
Hadn't thought about it. I don't know what you do with the 3 days. 49 would have been better.
I guess it would have been, I'm thinking right, it would have been 52 days from when Jesus died until the church was established. Think about that, right?
Something like that. Yeah. That's interesting. I don't know. Yeah, the times when I don't know that there may be. On the other hand, it may just be wow, it's a short time, you know, less than 2 months. So, but the way Bible uses numbers, it's hard for me to take the negative on any of those. There may be something. Yes, Jeremy.
We've seen it throughout the book.
He got those walls built, yeah. I mean, so finally God's house that they'd rebuilt decades before is protected. And just what a blessing. Other thoughts?
Let's
Mike.
Here in verse 16, when Nehemiah is faithful and persistent and doesn't give in to intimidation, the enemies finally quit. And, you know, like we sometimes say, you know, each time we overcome will give us more strength to overcome. So if we'll stand our ground long enough, yep. Satan will leave us alone for a season.
Yeah. Any inch we give just baits him. Every time we resist. Remember that passage in James, resist the devil and he'll flee from you. I heard such a good illustration of that that I've appreciated since then. You know what happens if a stray dog comes to your door and you give it a few crumbs? That dog will be back tomorrow. What happens if you give it a little bit tomorrow and maybe the next day and the next day? You've got a dog. Right? He's going to be at your doorstep every day. Now, what happens if that dog comes the first day? Zero. Nothing. Second day? Nothing. Third day? Nothing. It won't be long. You won't see that dog again. He's not going to come where he doesn't get anything. And that's the way it is with Satan. You think about it. You give an inch, and Satan will be back. You give another inch, he'll be back. You give another inch, he'll just be a permanent resident. You know, if you just say no, and you don't give, you don't budge, you don't... Eventually it's like, well, forget that. I mean, you know, I see people even with sin doing things like, oh, you know, this is tormenting me so much, I might as well just give in and get it out of my system. You never get sin out of your system by committing it. You get it out of your system by not committing it. You know, we've got to hold the line and be firm about it. And you're right. Satan will flee from us when we resist him consistently and we give him nothing to give him any hope about. Other thoughts? Okay, look at chapter 7. Somebody read verses 1 to 4.
The king of heaven, when the wall was rebuilt, and had set up the doors of the gatekeepers and the singers and the Levites were appointed. That I put Hananiah, my brother, and Hananiah, the commander of the fortress, in charge of Jerusalem. He was a faithful man, feared God more than many. And I said to them, do not let the gates of Jerusalem be opened until the sun is high. While they are standing guard, let them shut and bolt the doors. Also, appoint guards from the inhabitants of Jerusalem, each at his own post, and each in front of his own house. Now the city was large and spacious, but the people in it, few, and the houses were not built.
So, you know, we've got the wall built, but that's really not everything that needs some attention. So, Nehemiah deals with certain officials that are needed. He's got the wall rebuilt, set up the doors, and then he appoints the gatekeepers, the singers, and the Levites. Now think about the singers. You know, there's more to life than just the wall. The highest priority is to ensure that God is praised and that there's proper worship. Think about the Levites who teach. So, it's not just walls. You know, we got to worship, we got to teach the Word of God. So he's concerned about those things. Maybe the first glimpse we've got into Nehemiah's priorities and those things. Then he gets Hananiah's brother, and Hananiah, the commander of the fortress, and he's a faithful man, you know, which is what we need. And he delegates them to do what? And particularly of what part of the city?
Gate.
The gates. What happens if you have a walled city and you leave the gates open? You know, I mean, that kind of defeats the purpose for the walls, right? I mean, this is, you've got to still deal with this wisely. So he says, don't let the gates be open until the sun's hot. There's got to be a guard standing. Then you have to shut and bolt the doors. You know, and so you've got to guard it, and you've got to keep the doors bolted except when you're prepared to let people in and out. Now, it's interesting that Nehemiah's delegating this job. You see Nehemiah consistently being a man who's capable of delegating. It's exactly what he needs to do. And, you know, he delegates to reliable people who fear God. Those are the kind of people who can do this kind of work. So, the city, you know, is going to need to be guarded, and they're going to have to be watchful. Now, they got this issue. The city's large and spacious, and the people in it were few, and the houses weren't built. Well, you can see why that's the case, right? Why weren't there many people that lived in Jerusalem? Yeah, one safe. You know, who wants to build a city or build a house in a city that has the walls torn down? You know, in that era, that's like, well, you know, I don't care anything about this house. It'll be overrun. So at this point, you know, they don't have enough people in it. And that's going to be the next issue they need to deal with. Do you have a comment or question to this point? Okay, so what you get then, verse 5, then my God put it into my heart to assemble the nobles, the officials, and the people to be enrolled by genealogies. Then I found the book of the genealogy of those who came up first, in which I found the following record. So here he gives essentially the list of returnees that we had in Ezra chapter 2. And so you see all the people who've come back, very similar to Ezra 2. Now, the reason he's doing that, I think, if you'll jump over to Nehemiah 11 for a moment, they need to repopulate this city. And they're going to have to take volunteers, and then they're going to have to draw straws, basically, to find the people who can come back. They need about a tenth of the people to come into Jerusalem to move there and live there. And so they've got some volunteers. They're going to cast lots for the others. And so they start with this roster of people who've come back, and that gives them, you know, kind of a list that they can work from in order to try to find the 10% of the people that they're going to have move back into the city. Volunteers and supplemented by those that are chosen by lot to come into the city, like move in, build their houses, and populate this city of Jerusalem. Does that make sense? That's kind of summarizing that. But if you look at chapters 11 and 12, you see why I'm summarizing it. The other thing I want to point out in chapter 12 is that they dedicate the wall. Look at 12:27. Now, at the dedication of the wall of Jerusalem, they sought out the Levites from all their places to bring them to Jerusalem so that they might celebrate the dedication with gladness, with hymns of thanksgiving, with songs, to the company with cymbals, harps, and lyres. So they have this big, you know, celebration, worship ceremony of the dedication of the walls. They actually get two groups going opposite directions on top of the wall. And they rejoice greatly over this. They're very excited about what they're doing in doing this. I want you to notice one thing. In verse 36, they mention a bunch of people with the musical instruments of David, the man of God, and Ezra the scribe went before them. I said this, I think I alluded to this last night in Ezra chapter 3. But every time they tried to turn back to God, you know, I'm thinking about reforms and restorations like under Jehoiada and under Hezekiah and under Josiah and under Ezra and Nehemiah, they are concerned to go back to the sacrifices of Moses and the musical instruments of David. As we pointed out, Moses really set up the sacrificial system, and David set up the system of musical praise. And one of the things that I think would be helpful to us in one of the modern controversies, I think it's very helpful to go and really study Chronicles, especially First Chronicles, and study these later passages in the Psalms and in books like these that show the focus in the Old Testament, starting with David, on musical praise. And the focus on musical praise is very much in the Old Testament on instrumental praise. They were singing and they were praising with harps and lyres and trumpets and so forth. And you've got all kinds of focus and instruction and emphasis on that. And when they turn back to God, they are turning back to the sacrifices of Moses and to the musical instruments of David over and over and over again. That was just a real focus. I think we have tended to shortchange how much emphasis there is in the Old Testament on musical instruments. And I think that's very relevant for questions today about whether we ought to use musical instruments in worship. If in the Old Testament there was a reference or two or three to a musical instrument being used in worship, and there wasn't in the New Testament, you might just think that God had overlooked mentioning it in the New Testament. Maybe it's just not a big deal one way or the other. But when you see when God wanted the instruments to be used, he sets up all kinds of teaching and example and regulation and instruction about it, and it's all over the place. I mean, in the Old Testament, especially starting with David, you look at First Chronicles, you look at the Psalms, and you look at a variety of historical references like these, and the instruments of David are everywhere. And then you come to the New Testament, and you hear nothing. That's deafening. That's remarkable. Because, you know, it was talked about so much in the Old Testament. It's the same thing with animal sacrifices. How much is there about animal sacrifice in the Old Testament? You can't hardly turn the page without coming across another animal to be sacrificed. And how much in the New Testament worship? It's not there. Does that mean anything? Absolutely. And it follows the same pattern. Think about this. In the Old Testament, there was the sacrifice of physical animals. In the New Testament, there's the spiritual sacrifices of giving our bodies as a living sacrifice to God. In the Old Testament, there was playing on the harp and the lyre and trumpet in worship to God. In the New Testament, there's playing on the harp in worship to God. In the Old Testament, they cut off a piece of the flesh as circumcision before the Lord, physical circumcision. In the New Testament, we cut the sins out of our life, spiritual circumcision before God. In the Old Testament, there was a physical building where God dwelt, the temple, the physical temple of God. In the New Testament, God dwells in our heart, the spiritual house of God. In the Old Testament, they offered up physical incense before God as a sweet savor. In the New Testament, our prayers are incense to God. And you could go on and on and on with those. I think once you see that pattern, and once you see especially how much there is in the Old Testament on musical instrumental worship and how silent the New Testament is, the only instrument ever mentioned in New Testament worship is the harp. That speaks volumes. That says God wants us to worship playing our harp and singing today, not playing musical instruments any more than he wants us to offer physical animal sacrifices today. So that's just kind of an aside, but I think it's an appropriate thing to mention when he talks about the musical instruments of David. So they dedicate the walls here in chapter 12. All right, comments and questions on all of that. Really encouraging to be together and do this. I appreciate your patience and willingness and eagerness even in this. It's what I continue to see. I thought I'd say this just as an encouragement. You know, I see that a lot in some of the camps I do with kids in the summer times. Sewell Hall started a all-boys camp in Alabama, and we've got one now in Indiana and in Pennsylvania. And it's amazing, the kids who want to come. In my camp, you take 8 activities a day that are mostly Bible studies, and you have a prayer time, you have a singing time, and some other spiritual activities. And kids want to come. They're eager to. Almost no mothers and fathers make them. Sometimes they beg to be able to. What I think is that Bible study is fun. And when you start doing it, you start realizing that. And it's enthusiastic. It's exciting. And you want it. And I think if we just take from these last couple of days, more than anything, that man, look at these books. Read them. Think about them. Talk about them. Study them together. You know, we think, you know, fun and games is exciting. But the Lord's Word is exciting if we're believers in God and disciples of Christ. So I really appreciate your demonstrating that again and your eagerness in this. We'll talk some more tomorrow about Nehemiah 8 through 10. We'll probably try to deal with some things about that in the Bible class and then do some things at the end of Nehemiah in the worship service and try to wrap up at least the majority of the material in Ezra and Nehemiah. But really appreciate your eagerness and interest and your encouragement. Thank you.
Yeah, echo what Gary said. We certainly appreciate the encouragement of you being here, and certainly has been encouraging. We'll, Lord willing, be back tomorrow morning. I know many of you have churches that you normally attend and can't be here, but if you happen to be in the area, we'd love to have you and know that you're welcome. Haven't heard anything yet on Pam, so we'll keep you notified by email or phone calls if we need to as we hear something. So You don't mind, we'll stand together. Lee, would you lead us in the closing prayer?